Welcome to the Inside Elections Podcast, where we analyze elections in a nonpartisan, data-driven, and accessible way. In this episode, we'll preview an epic clash between House members and our colleagues in the press. We'll talk through the upcoming House primaries in Virginia, and we'll look ahead to November for some of Old Dominion's most competitive general elections. And for the first time ever, we'll do it all with two special guests, Adalie Ebersole of the Pet Food Institute and Laura Vozella of the Washington Post. Buckle up. I'm Jacob Rubashkin, deputy editor of Inside Elections, the go-to place for political analysis for more than 40 years. And I spent this past weekend hosting a cookout in Maryland's 8th Congressional District, which is represented, of course, by Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin.
And I'm Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections, and I spent the weekend at a soccer tournament at the Soccerplex near Germantown, which I believe is just a few miles away from where you were, Jacob, but in a different congressional district, Maryland's 6th District, represented by Congressman David Trone.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about Maryland congressional districts. It's like, well, you can step. It's like the four corners. You never know which one you're going to be in the way that they draw those lines. But for now, David Trone, soon to be April McLean Delaney, a lot of turnover in that 6th district out there in Western Maryland and also Germantown.
Exactly. And yeah, Boyd, Soccerplex in Boyd's. I can't believe how many soccer fields are there. But anyway, it's something you can't get in the city. So that's why we got to drive out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I've done a day or two out there. It's quite the complex. So before we get to our two discussions today, let's run through some very brief headlines. Nathan, there was a big primary night this past Tuesday. What went down in those four or five states?
Yeah, on Tuesday in Nevada, we got clarity in one of the top Senate races in the country. Republicans nominated Sam Brown, who will now face Democratic incumbent Jackie Rosen. So it wasn't a surprise, but clarity on the matchup there. In South Carolina, two Republican members who faced primaries won their primaries, Nancy Mace and Will Timmons. Over in Ohio's 6th district, there was a special election. This was a vacancy because Congressman Bill Johnson left to become the president of Youngstown State. Republican Michael Rooley, it was a closer than expected race, a significant Democratic overperformance. It kind of puts some future special elections, makes them a little bit more interesting, but that's a race to watch. There were other key races in Nevada at the House level. Check out insideelections.com for the full rundown on Tuesday night.
Yeah, that 6th district special election, I think we're going to have to take some time to process and understand what went down there. Not the kind of district Democrats should be doing well in. Very rural, white, not highly college educated, Appalachian territory. A 9-point win for a Republican there is pretty disappointing for them. The other thing that happened in congressional news this past week was in Texas's 28th congressional district, where Democratic Representative Henry Cuellar is currently under indictment for a whole battery of corruption charges. He was supposed to go to trial relatively soon, but prosecutors and the defense attorneys agreed to postpone those proceedings until after the election. That pretty much forecloses on any chance that Cuellar might resign or be expelled prior to the November election. That's good news for Democrats here, politically speaking, just because he has a real strength in that district, even as it has trended toward Republicans at all other levels. But he's still in a lot of legal jeopardy. Not out of the question there could be an early 2025 special election in that seat if he is convicted at his trial after the election.
Unfortunately, we're at the point where I think we're going to have to start a list of who hasn't been indicted right now. it might be a short list.
All
I promise we'll get to Virginia, but first we wanted to talk about the upcoming softball game between members of the press. The team's name is known. They're known as the Bad News Babes, against members of Congress. And to help us is our guest, Adalie Ebersole. She's a senior director of government relations for the Pet Food Institute. And she's not only a subscriber to Inside Elections, but she's a key organizer of this annual game. Adalie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me this morning, Nathan.
Now, before we get to the game, and I think you just came from practice for the game, but before we get to all of that, what congressional district did you grow up in?
Oh, I grew up in the great 8th District of Missouri.
And what was life like? What was life like in the 8th District of Missouri back then?
Oh, my goodness. You know, it's very rural, very ag-based. It was the greatest, I think, congressional district of the nation to grow up in. I worked for Congressman Bill Emerson, as well as Congresswoman Joanne Emerson later during college and then right after college. So, you know, very proud constituent of the 8th District of Missouri.
Now, I think that connection also gets us, transitions us to this softball game. How long has this softball game been going on, and what was the inspiration for it?
Thank you so much for that question. So we have been doing this wonderful game since 2009. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman from Florida, had breast cancer about 16 years ago, and she wanted to do something to really give back to that community that supported her during her diagnosis and treatment. And so she reached out to my former boss, Joanne Emerson, and asked her to be the co-captain in the House side. And then she also reached out to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York and Senator Susan Collins of Maine to be the co-captains in the Senate. So it's been a bipartisan effort since 2009. I'm just so grateful that we are continuing this wonderful tradition in the summer months here on Capitol Hill. It kind of gives everyone just an opportunity just to go in and have a little bit of fun and raise the necessary funds that we provide to our charity, the Young Survival Coalition. And they do just such tremendous work with the young adults that they help. They provide resources and connections and just, you know, a real sense of community for those that are battling breast cancer and going through treatment. So we are so excited for the game this year. It's just in 2 weeks. So
2 weeks. Yeah, well, we'll make sure that everyone has the details. I started to feel old there for a moment because I remember interviewing Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz when she was first running for Congress. And that was quite some time ago. Now
she continues to make sure that she interviews people that are running for Congress. And that's the first thing that I think she asked them, number one, if they're athletic, and number two, if they can play softball. So we are recruiting all the time on the member side.
And Jacob knows when we interview congressional candidates, we might be doing a little bit of reconnaissance because I will ask whether they have softball experience, and I can tip off some of our friends who are on the media team. We won't mention Bridget Bowman of NBC News, who's one of the stars, or our friend Abby Livingston, who's been involved for a long time, and say, hey, you might want to heads up. If this person gets elected, you might be in trouble.
Well, we definitely need more women in Congress and in the news press. So we are, like I said, we're always recruiting on both sides of this great rivalry. So I know both Abby Livingston is now one of their coaches, the Bad News Babes coaches, and Bridget Bowman is playing again this year. So we're excited to see both of them on the field in a couple of weeks.
I was going to ask, as we're approaching kind of 15 years of the game, tell us a little bit about how the game has changed, how it's grown as you've gotten some years under your belt and as it has become more of an institutional thing here in D.C.
Yes. So that first year in 2009, you know, we didn't even have bases. We had no equipment. We played behind the American Legion in that little park off D Street, and literally used the trees as our bases. So we have really come a long way, baby, as they say, right? So I think we raised like $20,000 that year for YSC, and it's just been so much fun to see it just grow from literally nothing to now we have, you know, wonderful equipment because we have great sponsors that donate that to the game. We also are now raising over $500,000 every year, and it's been amazing to watch it just really thrive. And it's all because of our sponsors and, of course, all of our fans that come out every year and watch the game. We have about 4,000 folks that come out to Watkins Field every year and cheer on both sides, the member team as well as the Bad News Babes. So, it's been such a thrill to be a part of this. We actually are now in our 16th year. We did take 1 year off for for COVID. So we did not play a game in 2020. So last year we did have our 15-year anniversary, and we're looking for, you know, to continue growing and to be another 15 years. So hope you both can make it out next or in 2 weeks.
Yeah. And what's been the most memorable moment out of, you know, all the years that it's been going on? Is there a moment that sticks out to you?
You know, we've had some wonderful just celebrity guests, if you will, that have thrown out the first pitch. We have had Megan Cavanaugh, who plays Marla Hooch on the wonderful movie, It's a League of Their Own. We have also had former Commerce Secretary Barbara Franklin. She came out, I think it was 2 years ago, and joined us to throw out the first pitch. We also had Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. She came to the game a few years after, you know, the horrible shooting that happened in her congressional district. And we were also excited to see her on the field. But, you know, I think one of the best things just over the last 16 years is just watching the camaraderie, not only between the members of Congress, the House and the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, conservative and liberal. Just they become good friends. It's really become a family. Some of them didn't even know each other. And so just to watch that, because those friendships develop, and also watch the friendships develop on the other side of the aisle with the bad news babes. You know, we all live in these 15-second increments, it seems like, on social media, but it's been fun to watch those relationships really develop and again, just become like a big family. And yeah, and it's just a wonderful game. So we're just so excited that it's happening again.
I want to ask about how kind of politics plays in or doesn't play into it. Obviously, when it's Congress and the press, politics is always a thing. But in the congressional baseball game, it's Democrats versus Republicans, and it can get quite political. I think oftentimes members look at it as a bit of a proxy to vent some of the frustration that they're having with their friends across the aisle. But in the softball game, it's Democrats and Republicans on the same team. Maybe an independent. I don't know if Senator Sinema has played since she became an independent, but
she has actually. She's a great base runner.
is there like a big sign that says like, you know, leave your politics at the door when you walk in to the locker room? Or how do you manage all those big personalities from across the political spectrum trying to play together on one team?
Well, and thank you. That's exactly what we do. We have kind of been our mantra from the very beginning. Like, we just leave politics literally, you know, outside on the field as we come into the dugouts in the morning and start practicing. We don't, you know, as a lobbyist myself, like, I'm not there to lobby these members of Congress. It is completely about our softball game, our charity, the Young Survival Coalition, and all the young adults that we're trying to help as they navigate a breast cancer diagnosis. So we really are mindful of that. And I think, you know, we want it to be a safe space, if you will. And we really try not to talk about politics, even though it's all around us every single day. I mean, you know, there are things that come up, of course, that is happening on Capitol Hill, just a few blocks from where we play. But we really try to just focus on why we're there. And of course, you know, trying to hone those wonderful softball skills. Most of the women that play on both teams are not athletes. And so, you know, they take this game very seriously. They're all type A personalities and they all want to win that trophy. And so we really are just focused on making sure that we, you know, again, help those young adults that are going through breast cancer diagnosis. But, you know, politics is part of it, right? So we
We're in Washington.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned a league of their own. Is there crying in softball when the media team beats the members? I mean, is there?
I think there have been a few tears shed, yes. No, the member team has won 4. The press team, the Bad News Babes, have won 9. Again, it is such a storied rivalry that I think the members are really, their bats are pretty hot this year, so they really want that trophy back. I think I've seen a few tears shed.
Well, I remember a few years ago, our friend Bridget, a legit home run over the fence, right? Yes. I mean, it was awesome.
I think that was the very first home run that was hit in the game.
We'll see if she can pull it off again. No pressure, Bridget, who previous Inside Elections podcast guest as well. So and Abby has been on before. So this is, we're all in on the softball game. But Adelie, tell everyone how they can attend and how they can support the game.
Thank you so much. So, yes, we play on Wednesday, June 26th. It's at Watkins Recreation, 420 12th Street Southeast. Everyone will go to the corner of 13th and D, as in dog, Southeast, and enter there to go through security. The game starts at 7 o'clock, but we open the gates at 5:30. And everyone needs a ticket unless you're under 5 years old. So tickets are $10 and they can be purchased on our website, which is congwomensoftball.org.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for being a loyal subscriber to Inside Elections. We appreciate that as well. You're doing everything for us, Adelie.
I love Inside Elections. I read it every other week, right? So, and thank you so much for this opportunity. We really appreciate the support that Inside Elections is giving us this year.
No problem. Thanks. And we will see you soon. Have a great game.
Thank you.
I want to welcome our special guest today, Laura Vozella of The Washington Post. Laura is a local politics reporter at The Post, where she's covered the ins and outs of Virginia politics for over a decade. We're going to get into all of the interesting races taking place in the Commonwealth this cycle with you, Laura. And thank you so much for being on. But first, sure. You got to answer the question that we put to every single one of our guests on the show. What congressional district did you grow up in?
Connecticut's first congressional district. So I don't know how exciting that is. Pretty blue.
And is that, does the first start out on the east, or do they go from the east to west or west to east?
All I can tell you is that's the Hartford area. So
that's the Hartford area. All right.
Pass through it on your way between Boston and New York, but I don't know that you would have stopped.
well, if someone were to stop, where would they stop for some excitement in Connecticut's first district?
Well, all right. In Hartford, it is the state capital. So for political nerds, that might be exciting. There's also a historic carousel in Bushnell Park, or at least there was when I was a kid. And Mark Twain's house is there in Hartford, which is pretty cool. And I believe a high school classmate of mine is now, we're both old enough, but he plays Mark Twain and gives tours there. So, and it is a very quirky, unusual house if you happen to be passing through.
I have a friend from Framingham, Massachusetts, and okay. We were driving from DC up to Framingham, and he talked about avoiding Hartford traffic like it was not just one plague, but three plagues. I don't know if Hartford traffic is that much of a
situation.
Maybe
if you live in Framingham, but although they have a football stadium, right? So he ought to know traffic. But having just driven from my home base in Richmond now up to the Connecticut shoreline where my parents live now, I just think Southern Connecticut and New York City have that. Never mind DC. Like that was the worst part of the trip, and it always is. So I don't think Hartford is such a hubbub.
Well, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
All right. There's a lot going on in Virginia. We're going to start talking through some primaries and then later go on to some general elections. But the primaries are coming up on next Tuesday, June 18th. Let's take a brief listen at some campaign ads that have been flying around on the airwaves in recent days.
When America needed a hero, Donald Trump chose John McGuire. Hear it from President Trump himself.
John McGuire is an American hero who served as a Navy SEAL. John is strong on the border, very powerful in defeating the drug cartels, tough on crime, and will always defend our Second Amendment. John is running against Bob Good, who is actually bad for Virginia and who will stab you in the back like he did me.
I'm John McGuire, and I approve this message.
Let's start with the one Republican primary that we are looking at closely next week in Virginia's 5th Congressional District. This is where Bob Good is facing a pretty spirited challenge in the Republican primary from State Senator John McGuire. Laura, what's going on here? Why is Good in so much trouble just a couple days before the primary?
Well, the short answer is he endorsed Ron DeSantis back when it looked like maybe DeSantis had a shot. And even though he couched it in terms of, you know, he didn't say he was opposed to Trump at all, but he did tell someone in what he thought was a private conversation, in, you know, after some event, somebody buttonholed him and said, why did you endorse DeSantis? And he said that he thought he was more of a true conservative than Trump. And then he went on and gave some actual legitimate examples of that in terms of abortion policy, guns, where Trump had flirted with the red flag law. And that got turned into a pretty brutal ad, making it sound like he was a big Trump backstabber. He claims in that same conversation, he called Trump the greatest president of his lifetime, but that he thought DeSantis would hold truer to conservative principles. Well, that did not sit well with Trump's team. As you might imagine, Trump came out and endorsed McGuire recently. So, but it is a weird combination. McGuire has a lot of funding from people who are not particular Trump allies, but they don't like Bob Good because he's been chairman of the Freedom Caucus. He's an unyielding conservative, right? They'd like to get rid of him. And so that's given both sides an angle to call the other, you know, a rhino. And who knows how it will play. I think the Trump endorsement is going to be hard for Good to overcome. And yet McGuire has some people who are annoyed that he jumped into this race before his election for state Senate was even certified. And he had sworn off challenging Good. So, and this is his third run for various congressional seats since he entered the legislature, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago. So they both have their detractors.
Does he have any friends left? I mean, the constellation of people who are arranged against him is so wide. Is there anyone who's still in his corner helping him out?
Well, there have been some Trump figures, I think even Steve Bannon, who've come and campaigned with Good. But it is true there's a organization that has been funding some independent expenditures against Good that, and forgive me, I don't remember the name, but I think there's Main Street in it. It's not a Trumpy organization at all, but because they're sick of Good, they're putting some money into it. But remember, McGuire is as far right as you can get. He went to the January 6th, you know, Stop the Steal rally, although he says he did not enter the building, but he is not at all, you know, a Main Street or mainstream figure either. But there are people who feel like, and, you know, I would say Ken Cuccinelli, I'm not saying he has a big following anymore, but the people who were originally with Ted Cruz in 2016, who wanted somebody who was more of an established far-right conservative, but not the sort of unpredictable figure that Trump is. There are people who prefer Good for that reason. And interestingly, I don't know that he's voting for him, but Denver Riggleman, I quoted him in an article. He is no fan of Bob Good, but he says he's more concerned about McGuire because he does feel like McGuire would do anything Trump asks of him, and Good believes in some things that Riggleman doesn't necessarily believe in. And, you know, Good didn't voted against certifying the 2020 election too. So I'm not saying he's going to stand up. He's a Liz Cheney figure, but he maybe is not quite so easily led.
And one of my favorite moments of this race didn't even take place in the district. It was when I think both of them made the trek up to New York when former President Donald Trump was on trial, and they, you know, wanted to be a part of the Republican crowd that was there to support Trump. And so it was just like, in what world is a primary in Virginia? Do the candidates feel the need to go up to a courtroom in New York City? But that's where we are.
Right. And then, of course, Trump did McGuire the favor of allowing him to be in his caravan. You know the word I'm saying. His
motorcade.
His motorcade. So in what world are we that is actually a bonus to be in the motorcade with the guy who's on the verge of conviction? But that's a big seller in that district. And that district is so red that this is basically the election, unless something crazy happens. So,
yeah, that was a byproduct of the redistricting. Because I remember back in 2020 when Bob Good was first the nominee, that was a competitive general election between him and Cameron Webb, who Democrats viewed as this kind of rising star. And then they changed the lines, and this district really fell off the map. So, potential new addition to our likely new members of Congress list next week if John McGuire can beat out Bob Good. Let's go to another district that used to be a little competitive, perhaps now is less so. But on the other side of the aisle, where we've got an interesting primary, north of the 5th District in the 10th District in Northern Virginia, where Congresswoman Jennifer Wexton, who obviously is dealing with a pretty serious Parkinson's diagnosis, is not seeking re-election. There's a really busy primary here as well. Let's take a brief listen at one of the campaign ads run this week.
Our democracy is fragile. I'm Dan Helmer. I served our country in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've seen what happens when extremists trample people's rights. It's why I wrote the bill to ban January 6 insurrectionists from holding office and led the fight to protect abortion rights in Virginia.
The Washington Post endorses Dan Helmer, one of the most effective legislators. He's displayed guts, independence, and intelligence.
I approve this message because we can't take our democracy for granted.
So that was an ad from Dan Helmer. He's a state delegate who is running in the Democratic primary in the 10th district. He is one of a dozen candidates who are running to succeed Wexton. You've got State Senator Jennifer Boyko, former State Speaker of the House Eileen Fillerkorn, Helmer, as mentioned, a state delegate Michelle Maldonado, State Delegate Dave Reed, State Senator Subhas Subramaniam, a whole bunch of really credible current and former statewide elected officials, Atif Carney, who is a former State Secretary of Education, some other kind of quirkier characters in the mix there as well. Laura, do any of these folks have the inside track here, or could kind of anyone emerge from this very crowded primary next Tuesday?
Well, I will say Dan Helmer has really led in the fundraising. That's Delegate Dan Helmer. So he's been out front, and Subramaniam, whose name I'm also stumbling over, I apologize. He got Wexton's endorsement. So those are the two that people, you know, that's the conventional wisdom. We could be surprised, though. But you're right. A lot of these people are, you know, serious established figures in Virginia politics, and maybe somebody's going to pull out a surprise.
And have you seen a specific challenge to candidates that are serving at the state level when they try to jump up to the congressional level? Is there something unique to the dynamic in Richmond that maybe either helps or hurts their chances as they try to run for federal office?
I mean, I don't think it hurts anybody except, you know, in the example we talked about before, and in some other cases where people have just been elected and they're suddenly looking for their next promotion, you know, even before they're sworn in. But otherwise, I think people feel that it's an advantage because you've been around, you've established yourself, and you have a voting record. Of course, I guess there is an upside to having no voting record too, I guess, so in some regards.
And it's a free shot, right? Because it's an off year election. Nobody has to give up their seat in the state house or the state senate in order to run for Congress, because they get to run in the odd numbered years. So it takes some of the pressure off if they lose, because one of these guys has to come in, fifth or sixth place, an embarrassing finish. There are enough current office holders there that someone's going to look pretty silly at the end of the day. But I think this is I think there's something about the proximity to DC that clearly draws so many people in. I mean, we see this in Maryland as well. The districts around Maryland, when those seats open up, they attract, every state delegate within a 50-mile radius. Even people who don't live in the district are like, "Ooh, this is my time." And I think that's a fascinating kind of micro system around DC that encourages such participation.
Yeah, and how does the Post, most congressional districts, their local paper isn't the Washington Post, like a national, even international paper. How does the Post handle covering maybe a more local race? It's a congressional race, but that dynamic is has to be unique here versus many districts around the country.
Sure. I mean, certainly we don't cover all of these races with the same intensity, and there are ones who, if you're in the Northern Virginia readership area, we would in the metro section probably have more coverage of a race there than we would for a congressional race that has no local tie, unless there's a tie-in with, say, a national theme. So certainly the Bob Good McGuire race, because of the nature of that, we covered that. But I don't want to make Representative Whitman feel bad, but we haven't written anything about his race, and I don't know that we will at all. Or the same for Jennifer McClellan, when the general election, if she has a general election challenger. It's just if there's appeal to a general audience just because of the themes, we would cover it. And then if closer into where the main local readership is, where people are having to decide where they want to vote, then we might have more, day-to-day coverage about, okay, here's how much money they raised, or here's the new ad, or, some of the allegations tossed back and forth.
All right, let's keep it moving. We're going to go southeast a few miles from the 10th district down to the 7th district, where we have primaries on both sides of the aisle.
This is our dad.
I'm Eugene Vimmon.
And he is running for Congress.
And I approve this message.
Jesse, hi, Dad.
Hi, Dad.
After 25 years in the Army, he doesn't always know what to wear.
Ooh. Dad sacrificed his military career to do what was right, so he should know when something's wrong.
I expose Trump's corruption, and I'll stop MAGA extremists who want to ban books and abortion.
You're right, but this is so wrong.
The big story in the 7th district seems to be local Democrats' inability to figure out how to beat Eugene Vindman, the former Trump whistleblower, in this primary, even though he has relatively weak ties to the district and has ruffled a lot of feathers there. He does look like he's in a strong position to win against a number of pretty credible challengers. Laura, what happened here? And is this really the case that Vindman is just going to be able to cruise through to the general election here? Or should we be on upset watch come Tuesday night?
Well, I mean, you never know, but he certainly has really led in fundraising, and the name recognition is there. I know that a lot of Democrats, there are seven in the primary, and really casts thousands between the Republicans and Democrats for this seat, and he does seem to have the edge. He has a message that should dovetail pretty closely with Joe Biden's message in terms of preserving democracy. So I wouldn't bet the farm on an upset.
I think the interesting thing to me is just that I think it really is an indictment of kind of the local party apparatus that they weren't able to figure out. They have four highly qualified women who are in this primary, all women of color, all who are holding, you know, either positions in the state legislature or in the Prince William county government. And yet they all are kind of appealing to a similar constituency in geographically, which has led Vindman to kind of be able to do pretty well in a split field and send, you know, the outside groups that we might expect to come into this race, like a Emily's List or Collective or Higher Heights or groups like that, all seem to have taken a pass on the race, despite, I think, tremendous frustration about Vindman kind of coming in and you know, not waiting his turn, as it were, skipping the line.
Right, right. I know there is a sort of a celebrity factor that that people resent. But I mean, we do have to face the fact that even if you're an effective state delegate, you're probably not a household name in Virginia, even in your own district. I'm married to a school teacher who probably pays very little attention to, you know, the General Assembly news, which means I can't come home and talk about it, and that's probably healthy. Whereas he saw Vindman's twin brother on, Larry David's show.
He was on. Was he? I didn't realize he was on Curb. Curb.
He was on Curb. Yes. Yeah. Twice, including the finale. So,
wow.
Anyway. Well, not to besmirch my husband or the delegates, but people don't tune in as much as you might hope.
Yeah. Well, that's always a cue. I think it's actually on one of the things losing candidates say lists that I've put out years ago is when someone, a state or local office holder coming in to say, people know me, like, oh dear, like they probably don't, like they probably don't know you. But you, to either one of you, kind of compare and contrast what happened a few weeks ago in Maryland, where you had Harry Dunn, a Capitol Police officer who was defending the Capitol on January 6th, who raised a ton of money, and he lost, right? He lost the Democratic primary. And in my mind, I immediately went to this race and said, oh, well, this might be bad news for Eugene Vindman, but the circumstances are a little bit different. So I don't know if either one of you want to, compare why this is different than what happened to Officer Dunn.
Nathan, I can give you about 4 million reasons why it didn't work out quite the same way.
This is not a 3-hour podcast.
You know, it's a function of in large part, I think, the outside support that the eventual winner, Sarah Alfrith, got in that Maryland primary, that UDP, the APAC affiliated super PAC, came in and allowed her to match Dunn's firepower, as opposed to, you know, the race in Virginia 7, where none of these other candidates, I think they've all raised about $200,000 overall, which is, you know, or maybe they have like $200,000 in the bank, I think is what they showed on their last cash on hand. And Vindman has like, I don't know, $1 million, $2 million, something like that. Whereas Alfrith was already kind of establishing herself as a little bit stronger than the other half dozen state delegates in that race. And then when she got that additional millions in support, she was able to actually outpoint Harry Dunn on TV, that looking at kind of gross ratings points, how you measure campaign ads, there was more pro Alfrith messaging on TV than there was pro Harry Dunn messaging on TV. And that made a difference. And it's just not the case here. Nobody is coming in to rescue Breonna Sewell or Elizabeth Guzman or Andrea Bailey or Margaret Franklin, right? They don't have allies who are doing what UDP did for Sarah Alfrith.
All right. Well, I derailed us, so I know we have I know we have other races.
So let's stay focused on the 7th for a moment, but turn our sights toward November. This is probably the marquee matchup or one of the two marquee matchups in the Commonwealth of Virginia in November. Open seat, of course, Abigail Spanberger not seeking re-election. What's going on the Republican side, and what might we expect from this general election matchup once we get through these primaries next week?
Well, we've got six Republicans, so no shortage on that side either. There are two who have led in fundraising, Derek Anderson and Cameron Hamilton, both, as my colleague Teo Armas wrote, both very similar profiles, even similar in appearance. They're both sort of elite branch of the veterans of elite branches of the military. One's a former Green Beret, one's a Navy SEAL. One's a little more seen as more mainstream than the other. I guess Hamilton's more the firebrand libertarian, and Anderson seen as a little more mainstream and maybe would be the better general election candidate. It is a very swingable district, especially given that it's an open seat. Spanberger won it, but so did Glenn Youngkin in 21. So yeah, that will be one to watch in the fall.
Yeah, I think Anderson clearly the favored candidate of national Republicans. I think House Speaker Mike Johnson put him on his speaker's slate to kind of indicate that he was the preferred. But I know Teo's story made a point of kind of putting them side by side, and physically Anderson and Hamilton look very similar. I think that's something that some of the other candidates in that race have pointed out as well, to try and distinguish themselves from the two of them. But it does seem like one of those two guys will be the nominee there. And I believe we have that race rated tilt Democratic, slightly Democratic leaning seat. But Spanberger, one of Democrats' better challengers in 18 and then better incumbents since then, obviously not there to hold down her seat for a fourth term.
Jacob, before we move on to the next race, this district could get more vulnerable for Democrats if President Joe Biden at the top of the ticket is struggling as much as what some polls indicate. Laura, you wrote a long story. I'm not just saying it because you quoted me in it, about how close is Virginia? Is it tied next, tied like some of the recent polls have said, or is it, is there something else going on? But I don't know if you have your own thoughts on where Virginia is in the general election and how that might impact this district.
I mean, if it is close. We've seen two polls, Roanoke poll and Fox News poll, showing Biden and Trump tied. And that's, surprising because, as we all know, Biden won the state by 10. Is that really where the race is? As I think you and others said in the story I wrote the other day, the Biden and Trump seem to be pretty close nationally and very close in states that you would consider to be more true swing states. So why would Virginia shift by 10 points and you're still seeing it close in other states? I mean, that's certainly possible. When the Roanoke poll came out, we kind of held off and thought, well, let's see. And then when a second poll came out, we, decided we should write about it, but let's have some other folks weigh in and see where they really think it is. The consensus seems to be if it is in play, certainly it would affect things down ballot. Would also probably not even matter if it's in play. It means it's a wipeout and Republicans won't need it unless something really some weird realignment is happening. But it's, as you know, it's been a pretty staunchly anti-Trump state, so much so that when Trump was in office, people kind of mistook Virginia as having turned fully blue. And then when Youngkin came along in 21, we realized, okay, we still have some swing left. We're back to purple, at least with a non-Trumpy style candidate. It would be a surprise. We haven't seen Trump put any resources into Virginia yet, but and he didn't contest Virginia at all in 2020. But like, you know, it's so early.
Yeah.
Hard to know.
And I still remember in 2016, I think the first, and I was not a professional at this point, but the first sign that it seemed like things were not going well for Hillary Clinton in that 2016 election night was when, I still remember this moment, the polls in Virginia closed and they went to, you know, Wolf Blitzer at the Magic Wall, and he said, Virginia's too close to call. And all of us were sitting there kind of, well, Virginia's too close to call for Clinton. Maybe things aren't going quite as people anticipated. So if indeed Virginia is too close to call now, obviously not a good sign for Joe Biden. But let's keep it moving. We're going to go eastward yet again to Virginia's second congressional district on the coast. Let's take a brief watch at an ad from the Democrat there, Missy Cotter-Smozzle.
Missy Cotter-Smozzle, a U.S. Navy veteran we can count on to defeat MAGA extremists and defend our democracy. Missy is the only candidate Planned Parenthood and Virginia Democratic leaders trust to protect abortion rights. Missy Cotter-Smozzle for Congress.
That was a video from the likely Democratic nominee in the 2nd District, which is based in Virginia Beach. Laura, this was one of the closest races in the country last time when now Congresswoman Jen Kiggins, defeated Elaine Luria, the Democrat. Do you think that it will be this close again in 2024?
Definitely looks like it right now. And again, where things stand with Trump could shape the races. It's interesting. We're again seeing a likely matchup between two military women who've been in the military. And of course, as you know, Jen Kiggins defeated Elaine Luria, who had been, I think, a Navy commander. And Kiggins herself was a Navy helicopter pilot, and now Smozzle, she's a former surface warfare officer in the Navy who then, only in Virginia Beach, went on to have an Italian ice stand. So business, I should say stand, like she's out there like a lemonade stand. But
I think it was Aritas. We don't have a sponsor, but I think it was Aritas. So.
Okay. So anyway, that's true swing territory. So I think we'll expect that to be tight.
Yeah, I mean, I think Laura, your point about the kind of the military angle here is well taken. You know, this is there's a tremendous veteran military active duty and veteran population in this district. Obviously, just south of Norfolk is not Norfolk,
right?
But Smozzle, a former surface warfare officer, Jen Kiggins, former helicopter pilot, Elaine Luria, Navy commander. Elaine Luria beat Scott Taylor, who I believe was a Navy SEAL in his military career. Scott Taylor took over from Scott Rigel, who was in the Marine Corps. You got to go all the way back to Glenn Nye, I think, to find someone who represented this district who didn't have a military background. But the thing that I like about this district is that, you know, we talk a lot about like the Bloody Eighth in Indiana, where in the 70s and 80s, it kind of changed hands every year, every cycle or so. I really think Virginia's second is the new Bloody Eighth. I think there have been 7 different members of Congress from this district over the last 20 years. It's just an incredible rate of turnover. And clearly, no matter kind of what the national politics is, voters here like to make changes in their representation with pretty clear regularity. So I don't know what that means for Kiggins this cycle, but definitely swing territory and has been for quite some time.
It's interesting too because of the tour. The other big industry besides the military is tourism with Virginia Beach, and for that reason, local officials are very pro gay rights, and so you'll see that in the Virginia Beach Republicans tend to be pro gay rights, which I'll say is very much an exception in the General Assembly. Typically, the Republicans are still very conservative on that front. I know it maybe nationally that's not the case, but that's just makes for a little different twist there, where there's a little moderation on that particular social issue. Maybe not the others, but.
This district is always fun because it has kind of an island, not a true island out on the eastern shore. But if you're just looking at a map of Virginia, you've got kind of the Virginia Beach and the Hampton Roads area. But then you've got on the other side, this other Accomack County and places that maybe don't get as much attention, very Republican areas. But I know from our conversation with Smozzle a couple weeks ago, she made a point of emphasizing that she was going to show up there and try and win those votes and win, or lose by less, I think is how Democrats like to think of these rural areas, try and get as many votes out of places that they know they're not going to carry at kind of the top level.
And to tie this into our previous segment, if Smozzle is elected to Congress, I think she could be a force for the members' softball team in the congressional softball game. So beware, members of the media, that if you should be watching this race, because Smozzle might be a force.
And finally, our last segment, Look What I Found. Where we highlight something new that we found or stumbled across over the course of the last week. It could be political, sports, music, movies. You never know what you're going to get. I will kick us off here. I found this incredibly zany rugby shirt, which looks kind of like almost like a CGI element in my background here. It's so different from my pretty boring apartment. But no, that's not my actual thing. My actual thing is that I found the AMC Georgetown in DC was doing screenings of the Lord of the Rings trilogy this past weekend, and I had never seen them on the big screen, but my girlfriend was like, you should go, you love those movies. And so we went to see the Two Towers. It was an incredible experience just seeing the Battle of Helm's Deep on the big screen. And I don't know if they're going to continue doing them. It was a packed house, but I had a great time. And the Georgetown there, not sponsored, but they do a lot of these kind of old movies showing. So highly encourage anyone to check those out.
You would be alarmed at my lack of Lord of the Rings knowledge or Tolkien knowledge.
Oh, no.
You would probably disown me. And I don't know, Laura, I don't know if yours has anything to do with movies. Mine sort of is along the same vein. I actually found that my Star Wars interest might be waning. And now this is in contrast to my boys. We have three sons, our daughter's older, who love Star Wars. They know everything. They've seen everything. And now we're trying to watch The Acolyte on Disney Plus, and I fall asleep within 5 minutes. Now that might be a more of a function of my lack of sleep and working and trying to cover these darn elections. But I also feel a little bit ashamed that how can I call myself a Star Wars fan if I can't even stay awake for 5 minutes on these shows. But that's what I found.
Wow. I'm not seen any movie or stayed awake for any movie for a while. I'm coming to you from the world of cooking and gardening, and I had a bumper crop of basil, and I made that and decided I should make some homemade gnocchi to go with that. It's an Italian dumpling, if you are not familiar with those. And some people make them with ricotta. Some people make them with potato. I do the ricotta version. You make it into a little snake and then cut them off and roll them over the tines of a fork so that they have little stripes on them. So I've made that for a long time. And last night I thought, let me try making it with, in addition to the ricotta, there's a lot of flour, white flour. So super healthy, right? So I thought, let me try it with some almond flour. And I would not recommend it. It wasn't a total fail, but they were too soft. And I at least I boiled a few first and tried it out and realized this is not gonna
work. Oh no.
So I could mix in some more, but just to save you that heartache.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that I think our listeners appreciate that, because
who knows who is going to try that in the next day or so.
We you saved them a lot of time and heartache and money, so that's awesome.
And that is all the time that we have. We hit it out of the park with Adelie about the congressional softball game. We toured Virginia's most competitive congressional districts, primaries and general elections with Laura of the Washington Post. Thank you all so much for joining us, and please join us again in 2 weeks. At Inside Elections, we provide nonpartisan analysis of congressional, presidential, and gubernatorial races. With a combination of reporting and data, we break down the key races and bring valuable context to complex elections. Go to insideelections.com to subscribe to the bi-weekly newsletter. We've got individual subscriptions and group packages that are tailored for association and corporate PACs. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast and rate us on your favorite platform. If you're watching on YouTube, hit the thumbs up button, leave a comment, and subscribe. If you don't like today's episode, please email Peter Jackson. We also want to thank our producers, Alan Tuzinski and Melissa Lenner of Pretty Easy Podcasts, and associate producer Conrad Tolosa. Please come back and join us next time.